Hi, listeners. It's Tucker Ligursky. As a researcher on Masters of Scale, I use the innovations of AI on a daily basis. And with an increasingly overcrowded market, it's hard to discern which ones are truly beneficial for my work, not to mention safe. That's where Grammarly comes in. My job requires me to prepare dozens of documents every day. And with Grammarly, I'm able to make my dossiers and research documents clear, more direct, and more concise. In fact, I recently discovered that Grammarly users spend 66% less time editing content, which is a huge advantage since our most precious resource is undoubtedly time. What I love about Grammarly is its commitment to responsible AI. My team works tirelessly to produce top-quality podcasts, and it's vital that we keep our data secure. Grammarly has been around for 14 years and has maintained a business model dedicated to never selling your data, which means you can trust it with your most sensitive information. Join me and over 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Visit Grammarly.com to learn more. That's Grammarly.com.
Hi, listeners. It's Aaron Bastinelli, an audio engineer here at Wait What. As you know, behind every successful business is a story. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failures, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
There's always going to be noise. I like to call it noise. Kind of distractions from what's important and what we know our ultimate goal is. Make short-term goals, intermediate goals, and long-term goals. To get us to where we want to go is going to be more of a long-term goal. Am I optimistic to think that we could do it in the intermediate? Yes. Am I hell-bent on trying to do it in the short term? Yes. But, you know, I understand the reality of what we faced when we got here, of how building the team, building our talent, building our infrastructure. You have to learn to adjust to your personnel. And maybe there's something that in your scheme and your vision of long term that you got to try to tweak a little bit. Be flexible and not be so rigid in what you want to have happen and live in the moment. And hopefully you can still build that personnel up to be what you ultimately want. You have to just try to tweak your plan a little bit to help them.
That's Jerry Stackhouse, coach of the Vanderbilt University men's basketball team and former NBA All-Star. With COVID-19, his team has faced cancellations, new health protocols, and a pandemic reality of isolation and empty arenas. He's also faced both winning and losing amid that environment. I'm Bob Safian, former editor of Fast Company, founder of the Flux Group, and host of Masters of Scale Rapid Response. I wanted to talk with Jerry because his challenges offer a compelling parable for the obstacles that every business leader faces these days. Leading a team has never been more complicated, balancing the high stakes of health, racial equity, and media scrutiny with the quest for performance. Jerry is both patiently tracking a long-term plan and impatiently pressing for improvement. And he's grappling every day with how young generations are responding to unexpected times and their intense desire for a return to normality. I'm Bob Safian. I'm here with Jerry Stackhouse, coach of the Vanderbilt University men's basketball team and former NBA All-Star. Coach Stackhouse is coming to us from his home in Nashville, Tennessee, as I ask my questions from my home in Brooklyn, New York. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me, man.
So this is your second season in charge at Vanderbilt, and it's hard to imagine two seasons that would proceed with so much disruption, right? COVID-19 cut short last year's NCAA basketball season, and since then, college basketball programs starts and stops, constant uncertainty. Leading an NCAA basketball program has never been easy, but these are new challenges. How has the job been what you expected it to be? And how has it been different?
Yeah, I think really COVID has changed things. But I think for what we are able to control, I mean, the basketball part of it has been pretty good and pretty steady. You know, being able to get in the gym and practice, and obviously the day-to-day with our athletes and them, you know, being full-time students, obviously that's changed with everything kind of going virtual now. So that's had some implications, as you might imagine. When freshmen coming in, you pretty much try to put your arm around them and make sure they get to class and do all these type of things. And now they're doing everything on their own. So it's about, you know, am I going to make sure I get on this Zoom, or am I going to get on my phone and get on social media? So it's been a little bit of a challenge, but our guys have been really great, man. For the most part, man, we got a lot of work in at the early part of the season. We had all of our guys, so we were able to practice. You know, the summer was really different. We were the last game at the SEC tournament last year, and then they shut everything down after that. So it was different. It's not like we felt like we were in a bubble by ourselves. Everybody was affected by not being able to go and see recruits, not being able to get on the road, and not having the normal summer that you would have leading into a college season. But, you know, for the most part, I think we've made the best of it.
Is your relationship with your guys different because of COVID, because of all the other things that are going on?
Well, I think so, man. I think they really value that time together because they're pretty much isolated. When they go back to their dorms, they're not allowed to visit with each other or really come and see with each other. So they really enjoy that time. And we enjoy that time with them, you know, the film sessions. Even when we have a light day and they're still hanging around the gym. I was like, we might as well practice if y'all still going to hang around the gym. But they just like, no, we get a chance to talk to somebody. So that's just the new world that we're living in with COVID. But I do think we all become closer because we spend that time together. And you're teaching them and they're learning. You know, they're having successes. They're having some failures. I mean, it's all new to us, too.
Yeah, the recent win for the team, but not all the games have gone well. There's been some media swirling as well. There's COVID, there's social justice actions, wins and losses. What's the measure of success for a program in an environment like this?
There's always going to be noise. I like to call it noise. It's just kind of distractions from what's important and what we know our ultimate goal is. We make short-term goals, you kind of have intermediate goals, and you have long-term goals. When I took this job, I knew to get us to where we wanted to go was going to be more of a long-term goal. Am I optimistic to think that we might could do it in the intermediate? Yes. Am I hell-bent on trying to do it in the short term? Yes. But, you know, I understand the reality of what we faced when we got here, of how building the team, building our talent, building our infrastructure. I think our infrastructure is to the point now to where we feel like we can really go out and have success. And I think that was why I was brought here. You know, when I got hired at Vanderbilt, the talk was about trying to find their ceiling. I feel like we've had some good basketball teams, but can we find our ceiling of really feeling, putting it all together, really investing into our athletics as other teams in the SEC has. And we got that commitment from our chancellor, got that commitment from our AD. So it's like, you know, we know where we are. The team that I inherited when I got here didn't win a game in the SEC. You know what I'm saying? And I have those same players minus a couple of draft picks. Yeah, I lost my best player. I lost 24 points out of my starting lineup on the very first game of the SEC against Auburn. And we've still found a way to win us three games. We feel like we're trending in the right direction with what we're doing and how we're going about it. I'm a firm believer that teams that play together and really understand how to share the floor together and understand the game of basketball can do some amazing things. So, yeah, when you look at us on paper, it's probably realistic to say, okay, they're not going to be there right now. They're a year or so away. I think differently. I think that it can happen for us and that we can beat anybody that we play. And I'm really excited about my kids, their potential to finish out this year. That's a lot of noise that comes with these high visibility jobs. And it's fun to when you can answer the bell. And I think our true fans, they understand it, that we're part of a build. And I think that they see the progress that we're making.
A lot of the folks listening to this are entrepreneurs or people who are trying to build their own teams, right? And sometimes they can get everybody they want. Sometimes they get who they have, right? And they're trying to go up against other teams that may be more resourced or more established in the marketplace. Are there key things that you anchor on about what kind of brings a team together, what makes a team work?
You can have a plan of what, you know, in your perfect world, when you have all of the personnel that you want, you know, how things could pan out. But then you have to learn to adjust to your personnel. And maybe there's something that in your scheme and your vision of long term that you got to try to tweak a little bit, you know, in the midterm. So you adjust. So I just think being able to be flexible and not be so rigid in what you want to have happen and kind of live in the moment. And hopefully, you know, you can still build that personnel up to be, you know, what you ultimately want, you know, instead of having to go out and outsource it and think you got to get another piece or someone else. Just work with them and eventually they'll maybe be able to accomplish the things that you want. But in the immediate, you have to just try to tweak your plan a little bit to help them.
The women's basketball team at Vanderbilt had to end their season due to health and safety concerns and COVID. How did that impact your team? Like, do your players get worried about COVID? Are you worried about it?
Yeah, I think we all are worried about it. I mean, it's like the happiest part of my day is when I get a text from my trainer and said, all COVID tests are negatives. That's the best part of my evening. I mean, we test 3 days a week. And I mean, I just said, you would think about, okay, the game, right? Like the game is not the most important thing for us right now. Getting to the game is the most important thing. And making sure that we have an opportunity for our kids to compete when they make all these sacrifices of trying to stay out of harm's way. And it's still, it could happen. I mean, it could happen at the pharmacy. It could happen at the grocery store. So it's real. It's a reality of living and trying to play college basketball in a pandemic. And yeah, I try to be transparent, make sure I have full dialogue with my parents and our athletes, because at the end of the day, it's your decision. We just want to go by the protocols. There's nothing wrong with opting out. You know what I'm saying? I don't feel comfortable doing this, but our team, our parents, they want it. We take extra measures here. That's something that I'm truly proud of, that we make sure that none of our athletes, if they've had any dealings with COVID or anything, that they're not getting back on the floor until they have their MRI of their heart and there's a ramp up. We're not just throwing them right back out there. You got to respect the things that they dealt with. It wasn't just the COVID things. I think they were dealing with a ton of injuries, so it was hard for them to really feel the team that they felt could compete. And then obviously with the emotional side of it. But for us, shortly after that, I met with my team and again, just kind of put it out there. We will not hold it against you in any way if you don't feel comfortable to be out here. But, you know, once you got a foot in the sandbox, you're going to have to stay in the sandbox. So I think that's how we dealt with that, and we've continued to forge forward.
Sports and basketball have played a big part in the anti-racism movement over the last year, especially the NBA. How do you talk with your players when it comes to the social justice issues? I mean, what do you hear from them about it? And to what extent is that part of the dialogue within the team?
I hear optimism from them. I think when we had the George Floyd tragedy, I really think it just shocked everybody. And I really wanted to hear from our players. I mean, I wanted them to put something on paper. I mean, I always made a project for them to write me and kind of give me their thoughts and how they felt. And it was a range. But I think the majority of our guys were truly optimistic. I mean, I think we got to learn so much from them. This Generation Z, you know what I mean? I think they just think differently. I mean, it's the smartest generation that we've had. Do they, you know, have all the common sense every time? No, they're kids and we still got to keep them on track. But they got big ideas about, you know, how to solve this. So I didn't spend a lot of time trying to talk to them about something that they're obviously hadn't been the right answers to, because we're still dealing with that right now. And it's a big part of our society. But the reality of it is let's try to educate ourselves, try to, you know, not let it be an elephant in the room. To be bold enough to speak on issues, to stand up for. And I think the NBA has done a great job, you know, with the Black Lives Movement, being able to allow guys to wear things on their jersey, on the floor. I mean, they really took the lead on a lot of that. Obviously, they got a lot of pushback and a lot of negative feedback. So, I mean, it just shows you that it's there, it's real, and we got to try to fight it together. I kind of left it open to my kids if they wanted to kneel, if they wanted to stay in the locker room. Some kids, like, maybe we could adopt some program or, you know, bring some kids into the games and stuff. But now we can't have fans at games. Hopefully, once we kind of get out of this thing, we can do some things more geared to addressing some of those issues.
So it sounds like they feel this, I don't want to say burden or necessarily responsibility, but the fact that as athletes, they are role models and they have a certain platform that they can use. And it sounds like at this point, they're limited in how the ways they can express that.
Yeah, I mean, like one kid, he doesn't understand it. He couldn't fathom seeing that. Went to a private school, so he never dealt with any type of police profile, racial profile, or anything. Like, he couldn't fathom it. This is a black kid, you know? And then I got a kid that was like, I don't feel comfortable walking on campus sometimes, you know what I'm saying? This is something that's right around us and that these kids feel, and we got to try to find a way to help them with it. And then there's kids that's like, man, it's been this long and hadn't anything changed. I'm just not optimistic, right, that it's going to change. So it's like, man, I got all these different views in my starting lineup. So it's, and we're trying to get them to play together. But no, it's just the reality of how different people feel about different things. And I think we have to respect that. But that's the most important thing, that we're not going to always agree. But we got to learn to live with each other and learn with different perspective and different views, different cultures. And I think that's what makes America what it is. It's kind of a melting pot of people that can coexist together. But we want to see it lived out on a bigger scale than it is right now.
Do they turn to you for guidance about how they should express themselves or like what's appropriate on social media or isn't? I mean, as an NBA player, I don't know whether you thought of yourself as a role model and whether you had a responsibility to leverage your platform. People didn't really talk that way, you know, back when you were playing, right?
I don't think you're just out taking a stance to take a stance on different things. And I don't feel like my guys expect me to go out and be someone who I'm not. I mean, I think, we live in our world, the time that I have with them, right? You know, my chief of staff, she meets with them and giving them, different little life lessons, and then they talk about those things. But again, it's not something that anybody really wants to talk about consistently. It's like it's the elephant in the room. You know, let's just coexist. It's unfortunate, but that's kind of the reality.
And do you feel like there's more that sports should be doing to have an impact then? Or
why sports? I think the athletes are doing what they feel that they can do. I think the NBA partnering with the Players Association to try to put major dollars toward fighting social injustice. I think that's a start. But, where is everybody else? Big business, Wall Street. I mean, everybody has a responsibility for this. I don't think athletes or the sports markets are responsible for the issues that are present. Could there be more black general managers? Could there be more black head coaches? Absolutely. But again, I think those are things that we just continue to push for and strive for. And hopefully we eventually get a little more of a level playing field.
Hi, listeners. It's Masha Mokutonina, a producer on Masters of Scale. I spend a large part of my day carefully crafting emails, composing documents, and endlessly responding to messages. Which is why I'm such a big fan of Grammarly, the secure AI writing partner I use on a daily basis. Whether it's reaching out to high-profile guests or coordinating logistics with the production team, I use Grammarly to adjust my writing to different audiences while maintaining the brand voice of Masters of Scale. Grammarly helps spot redundancies and clean up sentences that are unnecessarily wordy, verbose, long-winded, and repetitive, like this one. Grammarly's AI prompts help guide my writing process, personalizing content based on context as well as making tone adjustments intuitively. It doesn't just help me generate more content, it helps me generate better content. Amazingly, Grammarly works seamlessly across my email, Slack, and over 500,000 apps and websites, so there is no cutting, pasting, or context switching needed. Join me and over 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Visit Grammarly.com to learn more. That's Grammarly.com.
Has this been a stressful year for you?
No, I mean, I don't really get too stressed about much, but my team, I've dealt with some loss this year. I lost my father. So that, that's been all that stress, I think that's the real stress. I mean, I love what I do. I mean, this is a a blessing to be able to still be a part of a game that's I've been playing since I was 7, 8 years old, or even younger. But I think I had an opportunity to play it a long time, be a part of the game, and now still be able to give back and teach the game. So I feel fortunate from that standpoint. But yeah, my mom, you know, she's 90, be 92 years old this year. For my dad, obviously, they've been together all of my life and longer, and for her to lose him. So yeah, it's tough, you know, to deal with those things, but you know, those are life things. But I don't have time to be stressed. I have to try to just keep moving and making sure that I'm the answer to other people's problems and not try to dwell in my own, so to speak.
When we talked before, it struck me that you have a certain confidence about yourself. In whatever environment, you're going to find a way to make it through whatever's in front of you. Certainly the sense I got from you as a player, didn't matter what system you were in, you're going to find a way to have an impact.
I think it's being able to adjust and adapt, you know, even when people don't think that you can. I mean, I think it goes back to when I got traded to the Dallas Mavericks and I was playing, Don Nelson was the coach at the time. So it's like, Stackhouse, what's going to happen? Is he going to accept his role of coming off the bench? I'm like, man, I even got here. I hadn't even got to a practice yet. And there's already questions about what I'll accept. But Nelly, when we first talked, he's like, man, I got 6 starters. That's how he started the conversation. I got 6 starters. I mean, like, I was a 6th man myself. But you're going to play starter minutes. You're going to be there at the end of games. It's just only 5 guys can start, but I got 6 starters. And the way he approached that and just brought it to me, man, it calmed all my anxieties or any bad thoughts about it, and to the point to where I embraced it, man. And next thing I know, in that role and people seeing me in that role, feel like I accepted a role that, man, when I took off my jersey to walk to check in the game, there was already standing ovations in the gym. So I got pretty much more celebration from being a 6th man than I would if I was in the starting lineup. So I just think, man, that's it for me, being able to adapt and adjust. I became a guy who was called selfish early on when I was averaging 30-some points to a guy that, you know, I wanted to have in my locker room to mentor my young guys because I was able to teach them how to accept roles. And I had a real story to tell them and to share with them about how you can have success with less. And I think that's really the message that I give to our guys, man. Like, I know everybody wants to play a ton of minutes. I get it. But again, you got to earn it. And at the same time, be accepting of your role. Keep getting better every day in whatever role that's asking you, and your role can expand. And if you do that, I've never, ever seen it in any season of basketball where some good things don't happen for you. And I've been in the game a long time. So that's my message and my sell to them to keep working, keep doing what you're doing. It's going to turn, and I think they're starting to see it now.
You mentioned that the last game you played with fans was almost a year ago. What's it like to compete in an empty arena?
You know what, man, it's really like, I don't even notice it. I'm so locked into the 94 feet and the guys inside the line. Most of the time when we're in arena with fans, I don't even really feel the fans. You know, I'm so locked in on what's going on, trying to see all 10 guys on the floor. I think that's where you really grow as a coach, you know, when you're able to see all 10 guys and kind of what's going on.
Do your players miss having fans out there, or is it some ways easier for you and for them with one less layer of distraction?
I think that's been a message for them. Like, man, we got to create our own enthusiasm. We're better at it. We weren't good at the beginning of the year, but our guys have gotten better. They got some chance. They got some different things going on. So we go to other places and we're like the noisiest group out there, you know, because the fans are still having to be spaced out somewhat. And we're still there in that little circle. So it's like us against the world.
If I asked you, what's at stake in this moment for you, for your team, what do you feel like's at stake?
I think you're building your reputation as a coach. You're building your reputation as players. I think we all have aspirations of wanting to be successful. So, I mean, I think there's always something at stake. You got to be able to have a plan and understand in your mind what your expectations are, what your goals are, and you can't get sidetracked by anything. And I think that's the message to our guys. So I think those are just little life lessons that we try to talk about, you know, on a daily basis to stay grounded and stay centered, to know that, yeah, you know, we all want to be successful. But, you know, we got to do the things that it requires to have that success.
When you talk about being successful, there's a dialogue in some business about the value of failing and failing fast and what you learn from failure. How do you talk to your team about loss, about losses, about when you're behind?
I think you really have to take lessons from losses. We go back and we watch the film and we understand that we didn't do what we were supposed to do in this situation. That's why they scored. When I grade the defense, sometimes I put check scored, all right? Like we check, we did everything that we were supposed to do within our scheme, but we don't do that enough times. And I think that that's how we hold guys accountable. Like, you know, guy may have five mistakes. You got one blow by, you didn't, you know, help the helper, you didn't contest the shot, so that's minus three. You got a steal, you got a deflection, you know, or draw a charge, that's plus two. And so that's how we, you know, hold them accountable. And young guys, they're going to have minus nine, minus seven, minus, you know, and trying to see that the little older guys, they probably have minus three, minus four. And once everybody's numbers start to dwindle, then the game's going to do what it's supposed to do. Right now, we're top three offense in the SEC. So it's about the defensive side of the ball, making sure that we're more accountable there. I don't even have to be the coach. They know what we're supposed to do. So now we got to go out there and execute it longer and harder. We ain't worried about the losses, man. Like with records, man, that can turn so fast once you get on the road. But once they do it, man, we might not, you know what I'm saying? We good to run off 10 or 11 on these people. You know what I'm saying? That's the conversation that we're having. When are we going to stop beating ourselves? That's the question. That's how I coach. I want you to take pride in to stop seeing yourself on this film with me telling you this time after time after again. At some point, you got to be fed up and say, okay, enough is enough. I'm going to do my job. When enough of us do that, do our job consistently, we're going to have the success. There's no doubt in my mind that's what's going to happen.
And when those principles take hold, you don't have to be holding them accountable because they're holding each other accountable.
Absolutely, man. You said a mouthful right there. Like I said, it's cool for me to say it, cool for our coaches to say it, but when guys that you hang out with and you talk about like, man, this, you know, come on, man, do your job. You know, like that's the leadership, and I'm getting that now. We did it at a level that I haven't had a team that I've coached in the last 4 years do it against Mississippi State. That was the best defensive grade that I've had since I've been coaching. And like 68% of our defensive possessions we got correct. I mean, like, normally you're just going to be somewhere in the 40s or 50s, you know, just half. And basketball is a game of mistakes. But if you're doing it in the 60s, man, you can put that win on the left-hand side every time.
I noticed, like, these metrics are really important to you. When did you tune in on that these numbers and metrics was the way to measure the teams?
I got that from Dean Smith. Everything that I'm doing, I learned from him. We come in and watch those games. And it's like, yeah, Jerry, yeah, you had... You were flat. You got three mistakes and three good. You had good savvy. So you were flat. Well, I want to see you plus, though. I want to see you plus. You know, so it's like, that's my same spiel, man. Let's get plus. Let's get positive. So it's not, and I believe like the analytics, yeah, I know analytics has a place. I mean, I think it's a great tool, but he was ahead of the game. You know what I'm saying? You call it analytics, you call it whatever you want it, but I call it what I learned in Chapel Hill for playing for Dean Smith.
Well, thank you, Jerry. Thanks so much for doing this.
Appreciate you, bud. Thank you, man. Take care, guys.
Masters of Scale Rapid Response is a Wait What original. The show is recorded remotely using sanitized audio gear. It's hosted by me, Bob Safian, Masters of Scale's editor-at-large, and Masters of Scale host, Reid Hoffman. Our executive producers are June Cohen and Darren Triff. Our supervising producer is Jay Punjabi. Our producer is Jordan McLeod. Scripts by Christina Gonzalez. Original music and sound design by Ryan Holiday and Daniel Nissenbaum. Audio editing by Keith J. Nelson and Lena Sillison. Mixing and mastering by Brian Pugh. Special thanks to Emily McManus, Sarah Sandman, Adam Heiner, Kelsey Capitano, Tim Cronin, Charlie Meneses, and Saida Sapieva. Visit mastersofscale.com/rapidresponse to find the transcript for this episode, and be sure to subscribe to our email newsletter.